watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shining.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Last week, Peter Dale Scott laid out the concept of deep politics and the deep state, how those both inside and outside the official government work to maintain the dominion of a privileged few over the many by force, violence, and deception. Elsewhere in the world, they call it empire. And this week we're going to hear from people who've been on the business end of national security. The documentarian John Pilger has captured in his 2007 film, The War on Democracy, that I have adapted for radio and will be our first offering this week. The War on Democracy is John Pilger's first major film for the cinema in a career that has produced more than 55 television documentaries. It has been a hit in Australia and the UK, but like so many things made about the American deep state, it's unlikely to air on Americans' TV screens. The film tells a universal story, says Pilger, the story of great power behind its venerable myths. It allows us to understand the true nature of the so-called war on terror, close quote. And I would add, to hint at the truth behind the events of 9/11. I've not read installments from Genevieve Vaughn's book on the gift economy for a few weeks. I'll get back to it eventually, but I've not gone away from it, as it hangs in the air as the possibility of what we could be, how we could live. The War on Democracy, written, directed, and reported by John Pilger. President Richard Nixon.
Guatemala is going to enter a new era in which there will be prosperity for the people together with liberty for the people.
President George H.W. Bush.
The question is, why are we supporting El Salvador?
No, the question was, why are we killing priests in El Salvador?
The answer is, we're not. Now, you be quiet.
President Christiani is trying to do a job for democracy, and the left-wing guerrillas must not take over El Salvador.
President George W. Bush.
America will not impose our own style of government on the unwilling. Our goal instead is to help others find their own voice, attain their own freedom, and make their own way.
This film is about the struggle of people to free themselves from a modern form of slavery. Richard Nixon, President of the United States, once said of Latin America, "People don't give a shit about the place." He was wrong. The grand design of the United States as a modern empire was drawn on the hopes of an entire continent known contemptuously as the backyard. The extraordinary witnesses in this film describe a world not as American presidents like to see it, as useful or expendable. They describe the power of courage and humanity among people with next to nothing. They reclaim noble words like democracy, freedom, liberation, justice. And in doing so, they are defending the most basic human rights of all of us in a war being waged against all of us.
This is Caracas, capital of Venezuela,
one of the richest countries in Latin America, thanks to huge deposits of oil. The rich in Venezuela live in leafy suburbs with names like Country Club. Their spiritual homes are Miami and Washington. The majority live in what are known as barrios, on hillsides in breeze block houses that defy gravity. In the past, these people have been invisible, excluded from their own society. Today, they display the confidence of those who know an extraordinary change has come to their lives. This is Hugo Chavez, president of Venezuela, the voice of the barrios. Chavez and his supporters have won 10 elections in 8 years. He's the symbol of an awakening of people power, driven by great popular movements that are unique to Latin America. It's no surprise that Chavez, with the help of an aggressive media coverage, has become a hate figure in the United States. Because what he represents is another way, and a threat to American domination.
All right, now, Hugo Chavez, the criminal, speaking of criminal, government of Venezuela, offering
the criminal.
The criminal. It's a criminal government.
In my opinion, and the opinion of a lot of people in our government, Hugo Chavez represents an extreme threat not only to our nation but to our hemisphere.
He should have been killed a long time
by whom?
And anyone who believes by anyone.
Hay café por ahí.
Absolutely.
Do you want a cup of coffee?
Yes.
That was one of my English lessons in secondary school.
Do you want a cup of coffee? Do you want a glass of milk? Do you want a glass of water? English lesson one.
Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez.
Yo nací en un hogar muy pobre.
I was born in a very poor home, a peasant home, so I experienced poverty.
Yo fui un niño pobre.
I was a poor child, barefoot. My father was a teacher at a rural school. My mother, too. I had a beautiful grandmother. She was Indian. She filled me with love. My grandmother taught me a lot. And I learned from her about solidarity with other people, about sharing the bread even when there's little to eat. Later, I went into the army, the military academy, and I became a soldier. And there I found out about Bolivar, and started to realize what the truth was.
Simon Bolivar is venerated in Latin America as the liberator from Spanish colonialism. Bolivar believed that freedom only came when people united against all invaders, no matter their disguise. Today, the people of Latin America are again rising up against an empire built on an extreme form of capitalism known as the Washington Consensus. Whole countries have been privatized, put up for sale, their natural wealth sold to foreign companies for peanuts. In Venezuela, they've said, no more. This is La Vega, a barrio of a million people. Mariela Machado has lived here most of her life. She knows what it's like to be excluded in her own country.
I can give you a very specific example. On the maps, all these hills and houses did not figure. They were shown as green spaces. That was before Chavez government. Before Chavez, we did not feel a part of this society.
This is called a mission. It's a kind of parallel government designed to bypass the old bureaucracy and deliver real benefits to ordinary people. This is raw democracy, a triumph of the grassroots. today they're discussing the dream of owning their own homes for the first time.
Mariela Machado. We don't want the deeds just for our own sake. More important than the deeds themselves is that we own the property in order to develop our cities and obtain the rights that have been denied us for so long. That is the most important thing. It is not a matter of getting the deeds and saying, I'm okay now, I can go, and stop coming to the parish assemblies. Because after the deeds, there are better things to come, like the development of our barrios.
Soon after Chavez was elected in 1999, Venezuelans voted on a constitution, and this little blue book has become a bestseller ever since. This is one of a chain of supermarkets set up in the barrios, funded by the proceeds of oil. Here, prices are kept low, and on the back of every rice and soap powder packet are printed people's rights under the Constitution. Does it really mean something to you to see it there?
Nora Hernandez. Of course, because I didn't know we had rights like everyone else. But this one, Article 23, tells us about national politics and makes us feel included.
Democracia, lo dije hace un rato.
Hugo Chavez. Democracy, as I said recently before our people, as Lincoln said, has a simple definition. The difficulty is making it a reality. We are making a reality. Government of the people, by the people, for the people. A society where people are included and are equal, where there is no exclusion, there is no poverty, where human values reign.
For some of his supporters, Chavez has not gone far enough. Familiar obstacles remain from the past, a stifling bureaucracy and widespread corruption. And although poverty has fallen dramatically in recent years, it's far from eradicated. When you drive in from the airport at Caracas, the one thing that shocks a first-time visitor are the barrios, the numbers of poor people. Why is it in Venezuela, which earns so many billions of dollars in oil money, that there still is this poverty in spite of all the changes you've made?
Hugo Chavez.
Que los pobres de Venezuela siguen siendo pobres.
The poor of Venezuela carry on being poor, yes. I always say that we don't want to be rich. Our aim is not material wealth. It is to live with dignity. Of course, to come out of poverty, and to come out of extreme poverty above all. And to live with dignity. This is the objective, not to become millionaires, the American way of life. That is stupid. I'm telling you this because the issue of poverty affects us deeply. It's most of our daily struggle.
The daily struggle is made easier here. 10 years ago, this clinic would not have been dreamed of. Now, all over Venezuela, ordinary people have free health care, many seeing a doctor for the first time in their lives. For the first time, children of the poorest have a full day at school and at least one hot meal a day. They're learning history and music and dance, often for the first time, and all of this is free. Under the Constitution, the poorest housewives are now paid as workers.
Desde el mismo nivel y vamos todos. Nos preocupamos el compañero que.
There is now close to full literacy, thanks to classes like this. Catering to those like Mavis Mendez, age 95, now reading and writing for the first time.
The voices of elders. This means so much to us. The only thing I wish is that I was younger so that I could keep learning more. We never had a government that looked after the poor before or taught us to read and write. There was none of that before. I think it's never too late to better yourself.
This is East Caracas, home to some of the wealthiest people on earth, and what they call here the middle class. I dropped in on John Vink, who agreed to show me around his grand house.
Wow, this is such a striking house.
Thank you.
My goodness.
Thank you.
Yes. You've been here long, have you? Is this,
yes, I did.
This is the family home?
My family home. We grew up here.
John Vink has traveled the world, collecting objet d'art.
Have you collected all the silverware? Chandelier, is that?
Yes, that one I brought from Spain.
Yeah.
This is a collection of Delft blue. That's why I have them over there, so they don't break. This is from Peru, the silver. Mm.
But you're thinking of leaving?
Yes.
Hmm.
Yes.
Why is that?
Well, the situation of the country. It's, it's getting day by day worse. And
in what way? Can you?
In the political way.
Yeah.
We thought that this gentleman that's now in power, that he would change the whole situation because it was a mess.
Yeah.
But now it's a whole mess.
John Vink's view is echoed by Venezuela's powerful media, mostly privately owned. It combines banality with hardline anti-Chavez politics.
Venezuelan TV montage. Coming up, more dangers in the latest official decisions. Venezuela is moving towards a very similar regime to that which prevails in Cuba. For the government, what 21st century socialism means is simple: the total control of society by the state.
I mean, a number of journalists now say, well, there is censorship. They have been censored.
Andres Isara, head Telesur TV.
How can that be? They speak out every morning. They have their shows every day. They speak out, you know, constantly against the government every day. I mean, how can they say this?
I don't know if you have seen the programs that they have.
Margarita Lopez Maya, historian.
Anybody that comes to Venezuela and spends 2 days looking at these channels knows that there's no censorship in Venezuela. You just have to sit down and see those opinion programs between 6 o'clock and 8 o'clock in the morning.
TV montage. Hugo is evolving from a fascist to a Nazi. What's the difference between a Nazi and a fascist? Basically, Nazis murder people.
I don't think in any part of the world you hear the things that they say about President Chavez, about his cabinet, his ministers, the governors, the policies, whatever. I mean, it's even obscene in some kind, in some ways.
It seems to me that everything, including the weather, is being blamed on Mr. Chavez.
Dr. Martin Schoffel, businessman.
Nobody blames Mr. Chavez for the weather because it's the only thing left which still works, okay? All the other thing fell apart entirely. We're talking here 1914, Bolshevik Revolution, Russia. This is what's taking place here. And if you go now...
wait a minute. Look, we're sitting here in your... wonderful apartment overlooking Caracas.
In Venezuela, you say, es su casa. Is your
home. And if you're comparing this with the Bolshevik Revolution, there are no revolutionaries banging on your door, and none of your companies have been invaded. Your good life hasn't really changed. It hasn't changed, has it?
Yeah, but as I said before, it is now on a wait-and-see position. If I had come today on a two-year contract, as I did in 1976, I would fulfill my contract, pack my luggage and go, because I don't see any more future.
His critics accuse Chavez of building another Cuba, of being another Castro. And although he recently announced temporary presidential powers that bypass parliament, he maintains that his aim is solely to speed up reform. The irony is that unlike Cuba, capitalism has never had it better here. At the Caracas Motor Show, Ferraris and other luxury cars are sold. Smart restaurants and private golf courses and weekends in Miami are booming. What this class has lost is political power over a huge oil economy.
I think Venezuela, because it is an oil economy, its middle and upper classes are very much biased towards the U.S. and the American way of life. In a way, they think they are cosmopolitan. They don't feel that they are from this country or that country. They belong to the world. They belong to this kind of a privileged people of the world.
Miami?
Miami, New York, Paris.
We adore Miami. Miami is our second home. We discovered Miami because Miami formerly was, you know, it was a village. And we were so rich, you know, we went to Miami and we bought houses, apartments, bungalows, boats, cars, everything we bought in Miami. Mm. We were the owners of Miami. And so we are very U.S.-minded.
In the old Venezuela, the United States played the part of a mafia godfather. The deal was simple. For supplying endless cheap oil, the Venezuelan rich kept a large slice of the profits. The election of Hugo Chavez ended the deal.
George Tenet, CIA director, 1997 to 04.
Obviously, Venezuela is important because they're the third largest supplier of petroleum. I would say that Mr. Chavez, and the State Department may say this, probably doesn't have the interest of the United States.
Colin Powell, U.S. Secretary of State, 2001 to 2005.
We have been concerned with some of the actions of Venezuelan President Chavez and his understanding of what a democratic system is all about.
Hugo Chavez, I assure you that we tried to avoid a clash with the empire, but it was inevitable. I went to the White House. I shook hands with Clinton, even over the phone.
How are you, Mr. Clinton? How are you, Mr. Chavez?
We were trying to do the impossible, to have a revolution without crashing against the empire. It's impossible.
In Washington and Miami and the country clubs of Caracas, getting rid of Chavez became an obsession. In early 2002, secret plans were laid by the Venezuelan opposition, with the media leading the attack.
TV montage.
¿Usted cree que el presidente de la República está loco?
Do you think the president is crazy? It's time for us to start discussing the transition without Chavez, needless to say.
Anti-Chavez protesters took to the streets, their anger inflamed by the media.
Anti-Chavez protesters. There has never been someone so ugly and bad as this. Hugo, Satan, Chavez is the Antichrist, the demon, the devil, the dragon, Lucifer.
The campaign to overthrow Chavez came to a head on April the 11th, 2002. An anti-Chavez protest march was called in the center of Caracas. What they didn't know was that there were two marches that day. The other one was led by Chavez supporters outside the presidential palace, known as Miraflores. The two rallies were supposed to be kept apart, but then an extraordinary series of events unfolded. Without warning, the opposition marchers were redirected to the presidential palace by one of the organizers.
Wendy Olivo, photographer. He announced that the march would be diverting toward the Miraflores Palace.
People tried to stop the march from changing course, but the organizer was having none of it.
He responded, "I'm in charge here, so you can mind your own business. This has already been planned, and we're going to Miraflores."
The opposition marchers were suddenly herded towards government supporters. As they approached the palace, shots rang out. They were being fired upon by snipers, who shot them one by one, many with a bullet to the head. Soon afterwards, these pictures began appearing on anti-government TV, blaming the shooting on Chavez supporters on a city bridge.
TV news report. They kept shooting, aiming and unloading their automatic weapons. This will go down in history. Thank God there's this evidence. They're shooting at the people marching below. This is an unspeakable act of savagery. This is what they call a revolution.
However, as this camera angle reveals, there were no opposition marches on the street below the bridge. What the TV pictures did not show was this. The people on the bridge are clearly trying to protect themselves, crouching down to avoid the bullets of unknown snipers above them and anti-Chavez police units below them. The people on the bridge were actually defending themselves.
Wendy Olivo.
It was like a war zone that they had planned and were controlling.
Within hours, these military chiefs appeared on television. They too blamed Chavez and his supporters for the killings.
TV broadcast military chief's announcement.
El presidente de la República ha traicionado la confianza de su pueblo.
Venezuelans, the president of the republic has betrayed the trust of his people. He's massacring innocent people with snipers. So far, six people have been killed and dozens wounded in Caracas. This is intolerable. We cannot accept a tyrant in the Republic of Venezuela.
It was all a setup. The CNN correspondent in Caracas, Otto Neustadt, later revealed that the generals had recorded their statement before the shooting.
On the evening of the 10th, they phoned me and said, the march will go towards Miraflores Palace. There will be deaths, and 20 high-ranking officers will appear speaking against the Chavez government and demanding the president's resignation. This proves they were talking about deaths when there hadn't been one single death yet. It was all planned.
Soon, the presidential palace was surrounded by renegade army officers. Inside, Hugo Chavez was delivered an ultimatum: resign or be bombed. One of his cabinet ministers broke the news.
Ana Elisa Osorio, Minister of Environment.
No renunció, entonces va preso, que es un golpe de Estado.
Que lo sepa el mundo.
Que lo sepa el mundo.
It's finally clear this is a coup. The president has refused to resign. He is being taken prisoner. This is a coup. Let the world know this is a coup. A coup against the people who love them.
The plotters announced that Chavez had resigned. He hadn't. He was kidnapped. The following morning, an unelected dictator was sworn in. He was a leading businessman called Pedro Carmona.
Mariela Machado. They were all celebrating. I watched the whole program when they were on television. You can't imagine how much I cried, as if my children and my mother had died. And they are what I hold most sacred in the world. Just seeing how they said, a new dawn has risen in Venezuela.
In one amazing proclamation, democracy was demolished, piece by piece.
TV broadcast footage. We suspend the members of the National Assembly. We suspend the president and all the members of the Supreme Court, and also the Attorney General. And the head of the central bank, and the ombudsman, and the members of the National Electoral Board, crowd of supporters chants, democracy, democracy. Mariela Machado, you can't imagine what that decree was to us. It was such a terrible situation, because we saw the past, the repression, coming back. The need to struggle for everything.
In the United States, the broadcast media carried the same pictures and the same story used to justify the coup.
The Bush administration made it clear it is happy with the change in leadership in the country responsible for 15% of America's oil imports. Anthony Mason has our report.
In the end, this is what triggered the overthrow of Hugo Chavez. Armed gangs loyal to the Venezuelan president firing on thousands of anti-government protesters. After 16 people were killed and hundreds wounded, last night soldiers surrounded the presidential palace.
At the White House, the spokesman of President Bush rubber-stamped the story.
Let me share with you the administration's thoughts about what's taking place in Venezuela. We know that the action encouraged by the Chavez government provoked this crisis. The Chavez government suppressed peaceful demonstrations, fired on unarmed, peaceful protesters, resulting in 10 killed and 100 wounded. That is what took place, and a transitional civilian government has been installed.
Back in Venezuela, 3 years of modest democratic reform had been overturned.
Venezuelan TV broadcast.
Fortunately, we have a great weapon, which is the media. As you and the people saw today, neither the army nor the armed forces fired one single shot. Our weapon was the media.
The plotters and their friends had everything to celebrate, or so they thought. The next morning, distraught people began phoning one of the independent radio stations still broadcasting.
My soul aches for my son and daughter and all the young ones who will be adrift at the mercy of all these corrupt people who have thrown this country into total chaos. It's immoral. The hope of a people has gone. The Constitution is gone. Democracy is gone. The hope of the children is gone.
But hope had not gone. The truth began to emerge that the resignation of Hugo Chavez had been faked. His wife, Maria, confirmed this in a call to the radio station.
Let a handwriting expert check that alleged signature, if it exists, because I never signed.
And the people in the barrios started to fight back. Down from the shanties they came to rescue their president.
The farther you take my rights away, the faster I will run. You can deny me, you can decide to turn your face away.
This is a dictatorship. Chavez is a rightful president, and the people love him, and they will defend him.
No matter, cause there's something inside so strong. I know that I can make it. You're doing me wrong, so wrong. You thought that my pride was gone. Oh no, something inside so strong.
Hundreds of thousands surrounded the palace, demanding the return of Chavez. Faced by such people power, the army turned.
Es que, desde el punto de vista militar,
William Lara, president of the National Assembly. 98% of this country's armed forces have resworn the Pledge of Allegiance to the Constitution and the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela.
Roared on by huge crowds, the presidential guard who had gone into hiding retook the palace, and the plotters fled.
Mariela Machado. The young men, the military police who were inside the palace, started to hoist the flag. That made us feel stronger as we realized we were not alone. We stayed there until we saw a helicopter. It arrived at Miraflores at midnight. Then we all knew that Chavez was on board. It was a glorious moment seeing him arrive.
Just 48 hours after being kidnapped, Chavez was back in power.
Hugo Chavez.
Creo que la prueba suprema.
I think the supreme test was the coup d'etat of 2002. I was made a prisoner. They took me away and I thought I was going to die. Now, the Venezuelan people, the poor, without weapons, went in hundreds and thousands, went into the street to ask for my life, asking for Chavez to return. So I have nothing left to do, especially after that, but dedicate all the life I have left to those people, and above all, the most deprived, the poorest.
As ordinary Venezuelans celebrated the defense of their democracy, some of the leading plotters fled to Miami, and within days it was clear that Washington had cast its shadow over the failed coup. The Bush administration had gone along with the lies of the plotters.
We know that the action encouraged by the Chavez government provoked this crisis.
As these CIA documents show, it was fully warned and knew all about their conspiracy.
Excerpt from the report. Radical junior officers are stepping up an attempt to organize a coup against President Chavez. The plotters may try to exploit unrest stemming from opposition demonstrations slated for later this month.
Washington claims that it warned Chavez about the coup. This is denied by the Venezuelan government. Washington not only knew what was going on, it was backing and funding the coup indirectly. Documents recently released show that the Bush administration channeled millions of dollars to the Venezuelan opposition in the months leading up to the coup. The money was handed out by its principal aid agency, USAID, and an organization called the National Endowment for Democracy.
Eva Golinger, author of The Chavez Code.
During the six-month period prior to the coup in April 2002, the U.S. government invested more than $2 million into financing these organizations that they knew, at least 6 months before, were planning to overthrow the government.
You're essentially saying post hoc ergo propter hoc.
Roger Noriega, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State, 2002 through 5.
Because it happened
I don't think our viewers will understand that. If you could
Just because it happened after we provided support to these groups doesn't mean that it happened because we provided support to these groups.
Yeah.
It is a logical fallacy.
Right.
We would be very open and transparent about what kind of support we provided through the National Endowment for Democracy and other institutions.
In fact, the National Endowment for Democracy handed out money to groups whose leaders were given cabinet positions in the short-lived illegal regime. An official in Washington explained that this was merely part of President Bush's freedom agenda.
But I want to just be very explicit about this because there is, I think it's very important and it's in the interest of fairness to understand that the United States did not support that coup.
President Bush has promised to rid the world of evil and to lead the great mission to build free societies on every continent. To understand such an epic lie is to understand history, hidden history, suppressed history, history that explains why we in the West know a lot about the crimes of others, but almost nothing about our own. The missing word is empire. The existence of an American empire is rarely acknowledged, or it's smothered in displays of jingoism that celebrate war, and an arrogance that says no country has a right to go its own way unless that way coincides with the interests of the United States. For empires have nothing to do with freedom. They're vicious. They're about conquest and theft and control and secrets. Since 1945, the United States has attempted to overthrow 50 governments, many of them democracies. In the process, 30 countries have been attacked and bombed, causing the loss of countless lives. In my lifetime, the following countries in Latin America have been assaulted by the United States, directly and indirectly. Their governments replaced by dictators and other pro-Washington leaders.
Argentina, Belize, Bolivia, Brazil, Chile, Colombia, Cuba, Ecuador, El Salvador, French Guiana, Grenada, Guatemala, Guyana, Honduras, Nicaragua, Panama, Paraguay, Peru, Suriname, Uruguay, Venezuela.
One of the first to be attacked was Guatemala, one of the small countries of Central America, known dismissively as banana republics.
From the United Fruit propaganda film, Journey to Banana Land.
This is Guatemala City as seen from the air. People who live in the city dress very much like the people in our own southern states. There are many churches and people go to church regularly. They speak Spanish, of course, as most of them are of Spanish descent.
In fact, most of the people of Guatemala are not of Spanish descent. They're indigenous Mayan people and very poor. In the 1950s, 2% of the population of Guatemala control the natural wealth in collusion with giant U.S. corporations like the United Fruit Company, which dominated banana growing. On the board of United Fruit was John Foster Dulles, who happened to be U.S. Secretary of State. His brother Alan happened to run the CIA. Both were Christian fundamentalists who regarded any opposition as the work of communism and the devil. In 1950, this man, Jacobo Arbenz, became the first Guatemalan leader to be democratically elected by a majority of his people, who saw in him the hope of social justice. He was the Hugo Chavez of his day.
Greg Grandin, historian.
What was going on in Guatemala is that there was a democratically elected president in 1950, Jacobo Arbenz, who sought to institute a series of New Deal-style reforms in which the state had a greater role in both developing the economy and redistributing wealth. And the centerpiece of that was a land reform.
Arbenz was far from radical. His land reform policies were modest. But Washington was having none of it. Howard Hunt was then working for Alan Dulles's CIA.
So they said a decision has been made at the highest levels of our government to rid Guatemala of the Arbenz regime, and we would like you to participate in it. You will be the chief of propaganda and political action.
In Guatemala, what the CIA did was mobilize every facet of American power. It didn't just isolate Guatemala militarily and diplomatically, but it used the techniques of social psychology in a nearly year-long campaign, which created a sense of crisis in Guatemala.
What we wanted to do was have a terror campaign to terrify Arbenz particularly, terrify his troops, much as the German Stuka bombers terrified the population of Holland, Belgium, and Poland at the onset of World War II.
And that's what they did, so that the United States could control the economy of Guatemala, destroying the dreams of its people.
We sowed confusion through the countryside. And, of course, we had, by this time, we had aircraft flying over and dropping leaflets and doing a little harmless bombing.
A little harmless bombing and a CIA terror campaign cost thousands of lives. Arbenz, the Democrat now branded a communist, was humiliated, stripped naked, and photographed before being forced into exile. Richard Nixon, then Vice President of the United States, flew in to congratulate the new dictators.
That Guatemala is going to enter a new era in which there will be prosperity for the people, together with liberty for the people.
General Rios Montt was to be one of Washington's faces of liberty. During his time as president in the 1980s, thousands of people were murdered by death squads, most of them indigenous men, women, and children. His guns and helicopters came from the United States. President Reagan flew in to warmly endorse the general, whom he described as a man of great personal integrity.
Philip Agee, former CIA agent, 1957 through 68.
In the CIA, we didn't give a hoot about democracy. I mean, it was fine if a government was elected and would cooperate with us, but if it didn't, then democracy didn't mean a thing to us. And I don't think it means a thing today.
The crushing of Guatemala was Washington's blueprint. 4 years later, Cuba, just 90 miles from Florida, threw down the first direct challenge, ending Cuba's humiliation as a North American colony, a playpen for drug barons and the mafia.
Fidel Castro. They know now that the Cuban Revolution knows how to fight and win battles.
Washington would never forgive Fidel Castro.
Under the government aegis, we had
Richard Helms, former CIA director.
Task forces that were striking at Cuba constantly. We were attempting to blow up power plants. We were attempting to ruin sugar mills. We were attempting to do all kinds of things during this period. This was a matter of American government policy. This wasn't the CIA.
Cuba's achievements in healthcare and education are widely respected. However, for not bowing to the greatest power on earth, the Cuban Revolution has paid a high price. A 45-year economic war waged by the United States and the loss of vital democratic freedoms.
Jose Serrano, U.S. Congress, New York.
How dare you, 90 miles from my country, the last 45 years with a different form of government? How dare you haven't allowed American corporations to buy you out? How dare you continue this arrogance that says that you will never succumb to us? Don't you know who we are? Don't you know who these corporations are? Don't you know your life would be better if you could drink Coca-Cola every day?
What justified the attacks on Cuba and other Latin American countries was the so-called Red Menace.
We all know the atomic bomb is very dangerous. Since it may be used against us, we must get ready for it. First, you duck, and then you cover. And very tightly, you cover the back of your neck and your face.
Propaganda like this excused every American invasion, every toppling of a government, every assassination, every act of terrorism. The real threat was an orchestrated paranoia in the United States that became a super cult called anti-communism.
Philip Agee.
The true goal of the United States government is control. And they feel that if the United States did not control the governments of Latin America, then somebody else would. And the principle of government by the people, for the people, of the people, that is that's just silly.
This is Santiago, the capital of Chile. In 1973, the National Stadium was turned into a concentration camp as a military coup backed by the United States overthrew the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende. The leader of the coup was a fascist, General Augusto Pinochet, who rounded up Allende's supporters and brought them here. A young medical student, Roberto Navarrete, was one of them.
These changing rooms were used as what when you were imprisoned here?
They were used as
places where people were kept inside here, 50 or more, you can see that there was actually no room to move around here. Even all these places were full of people sleeping here, and there were no blankets or anything. Even some people actually slept here. There was very little room.
When they started to torture you all,
yeah,
what did they do to you then?
The techniques they used were beating you, especially in sort of places where it could become very painful, with a rubber truncheon, and especially the genitals and the soles of the feet and, you know, the arms and various places.
Over 2,000 people were confined here, many of them never to be seen again. Victor Jara was Chile's greatest balladeer. His songs had celebrated the popular democracy of the government of Salvador Allende. He was taken to the stadium, where he was a source of strength for his fellow prisoners, singing for them until soldiers beat him to the ground and smashed his hands. In his last poem smuggled out of the stadium, he wrote, "What horror the face of fascism creates. They carry out their plans with knife-like precision. For them, blood equals medals. How hard it is to sing when I must sing of horror, in which silence and screams are the end of my song." After 2 days, they killed him.
How old were you?
I was 18.
18?
Yeah.
Oh. Does the fear that you experienced then, is that something that imprints itself on the rest of your life?
Yes, but we felt it was part of what we were trying to build in this country.
What they were trying to build was a just, equitable democracy that took control of Chile's economy from the United States and its proxies. For the invisible people of Latin America, Chile under Allende became an inspiration. In Washington, President Nixon secretly plotted to destroy the Chilean economy. "We're going to make the economy scream," said Nixon. In Santiago, General Pinochet, America's man, sent in his British-made bombers against the presidential palace. It was September the 11th, 1973, a date that held an infamy and irony 28 years later.
Nathaniel Davis, U.S. Ambassador to Chile, 1971 through 73.
My wife and our children were at the house, and they had a marvelous view of these planes winging over and then dipping down and sending their bombs into the Moneda.
From inside the palace, Allende refused to leave, true to his promise not to surrender the government for which the ordinary people of Chile had voted. He broadcast this last message, then he shot himself.
Trabajadores de mi patria, tengo fe.
Workers, I have faith in Chile and its destiny. Go forward, knowing that sooner rather than later, avenues will be open along which free men will walk to build a better society. Long live Chile, the people, and the workers.
With General Pinochet in power, Washington again denied it had destroyed another democracy.
Henry Kissinger, former U.S. National Security Advisor.
We had no contact with any of the people that carried out the military coup, and therefore the coup that overthrew Allende was done without contact with the United States.
A very different story is told by these secret documents. In October 1970, the CIA cabled its man in Chile, "It is firm and continuing policy that Allende be overthrown by a coup." When that happened 3 years later, a U.S. official cabled back to Washington, "Chile's coup d'etat was close to perfect."
Fascism is a word that's often misused, but you've experienced it, the real thing.
Yeah, I think so. I think I...
When did you realize that you were ensnared by fascism? When did it manifest itself?
Roberto Navarrete.
I think it was evident from the very beginning. The ferocity, the sheer brute force that they use, the disregard for any kind of human dignity. I mean, their aim was really to make you into a thing. I think in order to protect themselves, because if they made you into a thing, then they didn't have to have human feelings towards you. They dehumanized you from the very beginning.
Once again, a Latin American elite was delighted to be rescued by fascism.
A country has to be well set, has to be well run, well worked, and see that everyone does the work. Because if they don't, then that country goes to the dogs. And this is the one man that's been able to hold them. I don't believe there's any torching done in this country. Because you understand one thing. Why torture somebody when you can shoot them?
This is where they tortured and killed them. Villa Grimaldi was once a palatial home in a suburb of Santiago. Under Pinochet, it became a place of horror. Today, it's a memorial to its many victims. Sarah DeWitt, then a student activist, was a survivor.
What was the date that you were arrested? Do you remember?
Oh, yes. I was picked up on the 3rd of April, 1975, 7 o'clock, on the dot.
So the junta had been in power for about 18 months.
Yes. So when I realized, someone had put what I imagine it was a gun, on my back and said to me, don't make any noise, don't try to run because we will shoot you. Huh. You are coming with us.
In a strange wooden tower like this, in spaces the size of a dog's kennel, people were tortured to death.
They took me to this room. They were punching me, hitting me, grabbing my nipples, telling me that I was a whore. So they asked me to take off my clothes, and they tied me up. And then they started giving me electricity. Now, the electricity was all the time inside my vagina, in my breast, and then it was going round, round my body, my legs, my arms. And when they did that, they would stop asking me questions, and then touching me everywhere and shouting, abusing. And then they would go, they continue with electricity.
Dwayne Claridge was head of the CIA's Latin American division in the early 1980s.
Chile, the only reason it exists is because of Pinochet.
At a huge human price.
What human price? Give me a break.
The thousands who were disappeared and murdered?
Thousands? You count them. What thousands?
Well,
and
I've
don't
seen...
Talk to me about truth commissions.
I've seen their names in the cemetery in Santiago.
Yeah,
you're saying they're thousands.
They aren't thousands.
Well...
They aren't thousands, sir.
There are thousands, each name documented by human rights organizations, some of them remembered here on the memorial wall at Villa Grimaldi.
You have a couple of friends there, like Jacqueline.
Yes, I have friends, mainly people from my training. There is a girl there, Jacqueline Drugy, another one, Cecilia Lamrin. She was pregnant, Cecilia, 3 months pregnant when they took her. They took another woman, Elizabeth Recas. She was 7 months pregnant. She went missing as well.
Doesn't bear thinking about, does it?
No, because sometimes, you know, I think about what were they feeling, you know, when they were being killed and why, you know, and, well, sometimes I think that I think too much and I start feeling, you know, like the pain. What do you feel when you are being killed and in such a way that I find it, well, I find frightening, really.
Yeah.
Because you wish, you know, that you could have done something for them. Such the isolation, you must feel totally, I don't know what do you think, really?
Alone.
Yeah, very, very much alone.